Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Over the past few years, from New York to San Francisco, cities and counties across the country have sued oil and gas companies, demanding accountability and compensation for climate change damage, including sea level rise and lying about the threat fossil fuel emissions pose to the planet. These legal challenges come on the heels of two separate investigations by Inside Climate News and the LA Times, which detail how ExxonMobil conducted cutting-edge climate research decades ago, and then, without revealing all that it had learned, worked at the forefront of climate denial by manufacturing doubt about the scientific consensus that its own scientists had confirmed. In 2017, Dutch journalist Jelmer Mommers reported that as early as the 1980s, Royal Dutch Shell's scientists warned the oil giant about the threat that fossil fuel emissions pose to the planet. That investigation mirrored similar findings about ExxonMobil a couple of years earlier. So how should this very powerful industry be held accountable for deceiving the public while inflicting potentially irreversible harm to the planet? How effective are these legal challenges, and how are citizens mobilizing to hold the oil and gas industry responsible for damaging their communities? Jelmer Mommers is an energy and climate-based reporter with De Correspondent, a Dutch news website based in Amsterdam, Netherlands. Jelmer Mommers uncovered Royal Dutch Shell documents as old as 1988, showing the oil company privately understood the gravity of climate change, but publicly conducted business as usual. Hi, Jelmer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for joining us. We're also we're joined by Dave Hassemeyer, reporter with Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonpartisan news organization that provides reporting on climate, energy, and the environment. Dave is author of The Dilbit Disaster, Inside the Biggest Oil Spill You've Never Heard Of, which won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. He also co-authored the 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist series, Exxon, The Road Not Taken. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Great to have you. And we're joined in studio by Janet Cox, an activist with Fossil Free California, an organization that addresses the causes of climate change by focusing on the public and private financing of fossil fuel companies. They also promote fossil fuel divestment by institutions and individuals with an emphasis on CalPERS and CalSTRS. Thank you. The nation's two largest public pension funds. Hi, Janet. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. Jelmer, I want to start with you. Fossil fuel companies are increasingly coming under pressure for fueling climate change. And now we know that they knew as early as the 70s and did nothing about it, but decided to fuel doubt and then also fund lobbyists to ensure that laws are not passed. And here we are today, right? So you got your hands on documents that revealed Shell acknowledged in 1988 the need to defend against a sea level rise. It also talked about other impacts of climate change. When did you start investigating Shell?
Well, I started in 2016, actually, with a call out to readers on the platform where I work for the Correspondent. And what I try to do is do a series of interviews with Shell employees. And the idea was to get a better understanding of the way that the company operates and the way that the people who work inside Shell see the world and see their contribution to climate change. And so I did a series of interviews, and that sort of got me a better network at Shell, and it also made it clear that I was doing a sort of thorough investigation into the company. And that led a source to share information with me that subsequently became public. So in 2017, we uncovered a film and made it public again that Shell had made in 1991. It's a documentary film which really clearly warns the world about climate change. And this film had sort of been forgotten about, but you can now go online and see it. It's called Climate of Concern, and I think it's really telling. So that was last year. And now this year we also published a set of documents, like you said, that go as far back as 1988, to sort of show how the company had done its own internal reviews of the climate science already back then.
What really stood out for you in these documents? We'll talk about the film in a couple of minutes, which is online for everyone to see. One document, mm-hmm. it was a confidential 1988 report titled The Greenhouse Effect, and it outlines a comprehensive study of climate science and the projected impact of fossil fuels, and reveals that Shell secretly had been commissioning studies since at least 1981. What really stood out for you in the documents you found?
I think it's the detail of understanding, and phrases like the people writing this report are phrasing it to their peers, right? So they're writing it for their employees and for the board to read, and they're spelling out that it was very it would be very irresponsible to wait to take action until global warming would be detectable. So they already knew that there was a lag between the emissions of the combustion of fossil fuels and the climate impact. And they understood that if you wait for the climate impact, you're basically too late to deal with the issue. Now, that kind of understanding is really thorough, and it shows that they knew that they had a big responsibility to warn the world.
Why were they doing this research back in the 80s?
I think, like all oil and gas companies, they had a long tradition of doing research into air pollution. And it's that sort of research which they had already conducted for a long time which led to this research field into climate change. And it was basically just them being responsible in the sense that they needed to know what was happening as a result of the combustion of their products. But of course, then when they find out, at first they sort of, at least at Shell, they decide to at least make a film about it and to come out and say publicly that this is a problem. Mm-hmm. But then when governments start to seriously consider taking action, Shell, like many other companies, joins the ranks of more misinformation types of campaigns to spread doubt. So this is, it's a mixture of both very detailed knowledge that they had and then very irresponsible actions that came after that.
Jelmer Mommers is a reporter with Day Correspondent. He uncovered Shell documents as old as 1988 that showed the oil company understood the gravity of climate change but publicly conducted business as usual. Dave, you and your team at Inside Climate News had an explosive piece a couple of years ago about ExxonMobil. They also conducted cutting-edge climate research decades ago and then did not reveal what they learned and worked at the forefront of climate denial. What was your reaction when you read about Jelmer's investigation?
I think the reaction that I had, and probably the reaction, you know, across the spectrum, was one of, first of all, surprise, but not so much surprise, because for example, we knew what Exxon was doing in the late 70s and early 80s. And one of the things that Jelmer made a quick passing reference to was that these oil companies were concerned about air pollution and smog. And that goes back to the 1940s and the 1950s, especially around Southern California, where there was a tremendous smog problem. And so the industry, decades ago and decades before they started climate research, started asking the question, what about the contribution to smog did their fossil fuels and burning their fossil fuels have? So this has been an issue that has reverberated across the industry for decades, and it evolved from wondering about smog, why, you know, the Los Angeles area was constantly under a brown blanket, to in the 1970s when the first increase in atmospheric CO2 was really documented as being on a steady rise. And so the oil companies, and in particular Exxon, decided it wanted to answer that question. And Exxon, from what I've been able to determine, talking with a number of people, both former Exxon people, people in the U.S. government who work side by side with Exxon, as well as academics, there was an honest question of what is happening. How much can burning fossil fuels, how much of the rise in atmospheric CO2 be attributed to the burning of fossil fuels? So I think on from the industry to government to academia, there was an honest question: what's happening?
Hmm.
When we read the documents, the internal Exxon documents, we see that its scientists were going to its board of directors and its corporate people and laying this out, saying, look, there is a connection, and we have to realize that, acknowledge it, and maybe start taking steps to mitigate what's happening. This was a scientific voice being delivered to a corporate board whose primary responsibility is profits. So that's where, you know, we see in the documents and the action of not only Exxon but other fossil fuel companies begin to diverge from asking the question, what's best for the environment, to what's best for our company.
Mm. Right, because their findings undermine their business model.
Correct.
Right.
Janet, you are an activist with Fossil Free California. This is an organization that focuses on the public and private financing of fossil fuel companies. We'll talk about those efforts later in the show. What is your reaction when this explosive Exxon investigation came out and now we have the Shell investigation? What's your reaction?
Well, I wish I could say I was surprised, but we're living in a global petrostate. And these guys are running the table. So I don't think I can even remember how I reacted when I first heard about the Exxon investigation, because it didn't seem like news. It just seemed like confirmation of what we'd all suspected, having been in this, watching this for a while. I think that the Shell information should add some credence to the Exxon investigation. And I wonder, David, if you can tell us how you think the Shell revelations are going to impact the investigation of Exxon that New York and Massachusetts have undertaken.
I think the larger effect may reverberate with the civil litigation being brought by cities and counties across the country. The investigations in Massachusetts and New York are focused primarily on Exxon's financial disclosures to potential investors. So it's really very, very narrowly focused on an issue of, did Exxon tell investors and potential investors what it knew, so that those investors could make informed decisions on whether or not to invest or maintain their investments in Exxon. Where the Shell disclosures will come into play is that Shell has been named as a defendant in a number of the civil lawsuits over the last 9 months. One of the big arguments being made by Shell and BP and other international fossil fuel companies is that United States state law, for example, California nuisance law, or even federal nuisance laws, can't extend past the borders of the United States. So I think what we may be seeing coming down the line is the legal minds representing these cities will now be able to take this and fashion their arguments as to why international companies should also be held accountable through U.S. courts.
Dave Hassmeyer is a reporter with Inside Climate News. he and his team exposed Exxon and what they knew about climate change and fossil fuels. He co-authored the 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist series, Exxon, The Road Not Taken. Jelmer Mommers is a reporter with De Correspondent, a Dutch news website in Amsterdam. He uncovered Shell documents as early as 88, showing that the company understood the gravity of climate change. And Janet Cox is an activist with Fossil Free California. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests about what these companies knew, the larger question here is, how should they be held responsible? I mean, we do so many shows about sea level rise, about coral reefs dying. There's so many issues connected to this. So what are your thoughts about how these companies should be held responsible? We have a tweet from Kurt who says, if we were an active and educated society, these companies would already be paying a price for their deception, but this is the United States. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. We're on Twitter at Your Call Radio. You can find us on Facebook on KALW's page. Click on the video and then leave a comment there. Jelmer, what kind of reaction is your investigation about Shell receiving in the Netherlands and really across Europe?
Well, it's been very diverse, so I think the documents themselves have been covered in many media, and I think Shell has gotten a lot of questions as a result of it. I think investors are starting to wonder whether they were well informed by Shell about the risk that Shell knew about so early. And I think one of the most important developments going on is new litigation coming up here in the Netherlands as well, by Friends of the Earth, an NGO, a local subsidiary of that organization, and they are filing a lawsuit against Shell for its contribution to climate change. Now, it's important because these documents show that Shell could already calculate very precisely in 1988 its contribution to the problem. So it knew that 4% of all the CO2 emissions that were going up were the result of Shell products being burned. So it also shows that Shell accepted responsibility for the combustion of its products. So it used to say that, well, you know, we only deliver the products, and then it's the consumers who use them, and so it's their responsibility what happens after that. But this report from 1988 shows that they already calculated the effect of the burning of their fuels, which also shows that they take responsibility for it. And this lawsuit in the Netherlands will use those kinds of arguments against the company. And so I think if you're asking the broader question, like how should they be held accountable, I think what you're seeing is a broad array of types of action. So it's investor action, it's lawsuits, it's civil disobedience, it's protests, and I expect to see a lot more of that in the coming years. Mm.
Janet, something that Jelmer said just resonated with you.
Well, I think the argument that we seem to be hearing from the courts, the cases that are going to be heard in court on Thursday, the motion to dismiss on Thursday, one of the arguments is that any kind of fault lies with the people who have been burning the fossil fuels in their cars and not the folks who've been selling producing the carbon. So what you just said, Jelmer, about Shell's recognizing their responsibility, I think, ought to be key in some of these other suits. Do you agree, David?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Do you want to explain what's happening on Thursday, Janet?
So on Thursday at 8 o'clock in the morning in San Francisco in Judge Alsup's court, which is in the Northern California District, I'll probably say it wrong, for California, the defendants in the suits that are being brought by the city of Oakland and the city and county of San Francisco are presenting a motion to dismiss, and that's going to dismiss the suit, and that's going to be heard on Thursday morning at 8 o'clock. And everybody should show up because it could be a wild scene. This is the same judge who held his climate science tutorial in March to prepare for this suit, and others probably know more about it than I do.
But. Yeah, there's a lot of suits going on. David, can we step back? Can you give us an overview of the various lawsuits that are taking place?
Yes. There are almost a dozen lawsuits now pending throughout the state of California in a number of different courts. And what's interesting about this is that we've already started to see a divergence of legal opinion by judges hearing these cases. The case that's going to be the dismissal motion that's going to be heard in San Francisco on Thursday is going to be in front of a judge who has determined that the federal courts are the most appropriate venue to adjudicate these claims. Well, at the same time, another federal judge in the same courthouse, separated by only two floors from this other judge, ruled just the opposite in cases brought by the city of Imperial Beach and the counties of Marin and San Mateo. In that instance, a federal judge said, you're right, these are state claims based on state nuisance claims, and they are best adjudicated in state courts of California. So right from almost the starting gate, we are starting to see the divergence of opinions. What's also interesting about these cases now is that the cases in San Francisco, brought by San Francisco and Oakland, focus primarily on sea level rise and the damage being caused, and that has been caused already by sea level rise, and what the future damages may be related to sea level rise. Cases are now being brought across the country, and the one that comes quickly to mind are the lawsuits filed by two counties and one city in the state of Colorado. They go beyond, obviously, they don't have sea level rise, so they are addressing issues such as wildfires, such as drought and lack of snowpack. We're also seeing cases, for example, out of Imperial Beach, where the small city that has a budget of $19 million, you know, is facing hundreds of millions of dollars in costs to mitigate climate change damage, again, primarily sea level rise. But they're going beyond sea level rise, and they're saying, look, we as a city, we have to balance our budget and deal with sea level rise, but when we do that, we deny some just basic public necessities to our community, such as funding the senior center, contributing money to the Boys and Girls Club. So these smaller cities have truly issues of the heart that they're dealing with. Hmm. They have to save and protect their city, but at the same time, they have to maintain a quality of life for the people living in their cities.
Dave Hassmeyer is a reporter with Inside Climate News. Jelmer Mommers is a reporter with Day Correspondent. Jelmer, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, great. Sure. And Janet Cox is an activist with Fossil Free California. On today's One Planet series, we are talking about how oil companies should be held responsible for knowing about the damage fossil fuels contribute to climate change and then deceiving the public about it. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about how oil and gas companies should be held accountable for deceiving the public about climate change. I'm sure that you've read the ExxonMobil explosive investigation, or at least heard about it, from Dave Hassemeyer and his team at Inside Climate News. He co-authored the 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist series, Exxon, The Road Not Taken. Today, we're joined also by Jelmer Mommers, energy and climate reporter with Day Correspondent, a Dutch news website in Amsterdam. He uncovered Shell documents as old as 1988, showing the company privately understood the gravity of climate change, but publicly conducted business as usual. And Janet Cox is an activist with Fossil Free California. They address the causes of climate change by focusing on the public and private financing of fossil fuel companies. Jelmer, going back to Europe, how many countries are mounting legal challenges? And how would you say European courts treat massive corporations like Shell? What differences do you see between the United States and Europe?
Well, that's a good question. I think I would have a hard time to give you a number of court cases going on about climate change. I think it's substantially less than the U.S. It may be 1/20th or something like that, because the thing is we're a less litigious community or culture. So in the U.S., it's much more common to take an issue to court. Here in the Netherlands and in the rest of Europe, I think it's less common. But, I mean, Shell is facing a super wide range of lawsuits about its climate change impacts, but also about corruption, about oil spills in Nigeria, for instance. So there's all kinds of lawsuits. But the climate change lawsuits are especially going on in the U.S., with a few exceptions. One interesting one is in Germany against a coal company, RWE. But that lawsuit is actually filed by a Peruvian farmer.
Hmm.
So that's an interesting one. The story is that the Peruvian farmer is at risk, at flood risk from a mountaintop lake, and his community is facing great risk. And he argues that 1.6% of the emissions that have gone up in the air since the Industrial Revolution are traceable back to this company, RWE. And so at least that percentage of the cost that he is incurring or is going to incur to take flood prevention measures should pay by that company. And because it's a German company, they're taking it to court in Germany. And actually, the first judge had sort of waved the case away, but now they're actually continuing it, and they're hearing experts. So that's a huge step forward for climate change law.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Sunnyvale. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, I really kind of find lawsuits to be pretty petty. The damage that these companies have caused is global, and it affects people from, you know, all over the world, and it will for many generations to come. These companies should be taken over, and the funds be used to come up with a mechanical way of dealing with these greenhouse gases that their products have created. It's astonishing to me as a consumer that all the driving that I've done, all that greenhouse gas is basically still in the atmosphere and will be for forever. You know, the life cycle is just, you know, it's just a forever life cycle. It's absorbed by trees and plants, and then it's, when those die, it goes right back into the atmosphere. I don't think many consumers know that.
Hmm.
And the fact that they have known all of this information for over 20 years shows how incredibly irresponsible they are as companies. You know, we have in California an 8-year drought, but we, you know, they estimate over 100 million trees died. Texas, you know, drought forever. Hundreds of thousands of cattle died. Farmers lost their land. They have, you know, drought and, you know, just, you know, people are not able to grow their own food in other parts of the world right now. The famine, I mean, it's just the ripple effects are going to be for generations to come. And this, you know, is a direct, when they had the information, they didn't give it to us. And now we're all feeling the effects.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, the list that you just listed is very long, and we could add so much more to that. Thank you for calling in, Greg. Dave, what about that? I mean, a lot of people are saying these, yes, okay, lawsuits, but as our caller just said, Greg, they're petty. These companies really need to be held responsible, in his words, taken over at this point.
But, you know, there is still a process in this country And that's what the courts are for. That's why we have a coalition of state attorneys generals who are, you know, investigating and looking at the industry, putting pressure on the industry. I understand the absolute need for redress, and these communities that are suffering the immediate consequences of sea level rise, they need the funds to mitigate. But it has to be done the right way. The legal process has to be followed. And, you know, in the end, the hope is that these companies will be held responsible, because the parallel that is often used is the big tobacco case.
Mm-hmm.
And that took more than a decade. But big tobacco was held accountable and is still being held accountable. So, you know, it is going to take one step at a time for these cities to gain the accountability that they seek.
Hmm. Gelmer, what are your thoughts about that? And I would love to know, as someone who is not an American, you are joining us from Amsterdam. You know, we have the Republican Party are now climate deniers. I mean, they don't. You know, it's shocking, actually, what comes from politicians in this country. What are your thoughts about the caller's response? And as someone who lives outside of the United States, what do you think about just the political conversation around climate change in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think, to be frank, I think it's terrible. And I think the world suffers from it.
Mm.
Because the myths that have been constructed about climate change in the U.S. have found their way into debates around the whole world.
Hmm.
So it's really bad, actually. And some, you know, prominent Republicans and even your president making false claims about this topic is not necessarily helpful for people that are seeking to change the political discourse in their own country.
Hmm.
I understand why it happens in your country, but you know, it does get easier for certain politicians in other countries to also ignore the issue.
Wow. Gelmer, what are you working on right now? How are you going to follow up on this?
Well, this Tuesday, Shell is holding an annual general meeting in the Netherlands, and they are looking at a shareholder resolution that has been filed for the third subsequent year, and it's looking to get more support this year than the last. It probably won't make it, but anyway, the shareholder resolution is asking for the directors to set targets for Shell to align itself with the Paris Climate Treaty. Now, of course, the company has told investors they shouldn't support this this resolution, because they already have a plan to align themselves with Paris. I could go on about that for a while, because it's not exactly true. But that's one of the first things I'll be reporting on this coming Tuesday. And I hope to follow the company for years to come. I think one of the very interesting things that have been reported in the U.S. about Exxon is that they changed their own operations to take into account the consequences of climate change. And we haven't seen that kind of evidence for Shell, but I'm quite sure it's there. So that's definitely a focus area.
Mm. Well, Gelmer, thank you for your reporting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you. Gelmer Mommers is an energy and climate reporter with De Correspondent, a Dutch news website based in Amsterdam. He uncovered Shell documents as old as 1988, showing that the company knew about the gravity of climate change, but publicly conducted business as usual. And if you get a chance, I hope you can go to our website and take a look at the film that the company made in 1999, Climate of Concern, which talks about how fossil fuel burning was warming the world and that serious consequences could result. The film also said that the planet's temperature could rise by as much as 4 degrees. It offers renewable energy sources as an alternative. I mean, this is really shocking to see, Janet, this film made by Shell, which was shown in universities and schools, but since has just been kind of underground.
Well, we can fix that. We can start spreading it around, and it, you know, let's make this thing go viral.
Well, as an activist with Fossil Free California, what did you think about our last caller who said these lawsuits are petty? I mean, we are in a major crisis right now. We need more than lawsuits. How do you see it?
Well, I wish I could think of an alternative that would work. You know, I mean, I can't imagine the governments of the world being ready to take, you know, to nationalize the oil companies everywhere. It'd be wonderful if it would happen, but in the United States, the oil companies apparently own the government. So I think David's right. You sort of have to go step by step and start with the courts and make the strongest arguments you can. You know, we're in a race against time here, and with luck, things will move quickly. But I think that the advantage of the lawsuits is that people hear about them, and the public needs to understand what this fight is about. And I think publicizing the lawsuits is a major contribution to that. And we all need to be talking about, you know, what's going on and wondering with each other what's going on, because it's pretty hard to tell. Mm. I completely agree with the caller. I wish there was a way to just make this happen, but I can't see this government doing the brave thing, the brave right thing.
Well, thank you for calling, Greg. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking today about how oil companies should be held responsible for doing extensive research decades ago about climate change, and then not only not telling the public about it, but funding climate denial and funding lobbyists to ensure that we do not have laws to actually tackle these issues. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Speaking of lawsuits, Dave, the one in New York has gotten a lot of attention, and you recently wrote about this. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman resigned over really horrific sexual assault allegations. He spent 3 years digging into a possible fraud case against Exxon over what the oil giant told investors and the public about climate change. How do you think his resignation will affect the case against Exxon in New York?
You know, I had that very same question. And I took that question to the Attorney General of Maryland, Brian Frosch. I took that question to the former Attorney General of Massachusetts, Martha Coakley, and I asked them, what's going to happen? And the answer that I got from them is probably nothing's going to happen. The investigation will proceed, because Schneiderman was the public face. Mm-hmm. He, in all likelihood, did not have hands-on with this investigation. He set the course right after we published our series of stories, when he issued his subpoenas of Exxon. But since then, it's been delegated to a legal staff of attorneys and investigators. They're the ones who are going to continue this investigation. And in fact, the acting attorney general, while not addressing the Exxon investigation specifically, within a day of Schneiderman's resignation, went public and said, the course of this office isn't going to change. We are going to continue to pursue our investigations in the public good. So I think the answer that I'm hearing is that Schneiderman's resignation will have very little effect on the New York investigation, and certainly not on the Massachusetts investigation.
What are these investigations calling for exactly?
The two investigations are looking at whether or not Exxon misled investors. And it goes back to that, you know, Watergate-esque question. What did Exxon know, and when did it know it? And then it extends, and what did it tell investors? So Exxon is being investigated in Massachusetts and New York under the various state fraud and securities laws.
So,
right after our series published, there was a call for a U.S. Department of Justice investigation, an investigation that could have resulted in a criminal case. That has gone nowhere in the last 3.5 years.
So I've got a question. How do you explain California Attorney General Javier Becerra's unwillingness to commit publicly to joining Massachusetts and New York in investigating Exxon? There's been a vast amount of pressure on the guy ever since the minute he was appointed by Jerry Brown. But it seems baffling to me that he isn't about to say whether or not he's investigating. I mean, there's no element of surprise here, but what do you hear about that in your reporting?
Just a quick aside, it has become a campaign issue. Dave Jones, who is challenging Becerra for California Attorney General, is making an issue of that very thing in his campaign.
Well, there's more to it than that, because, I mean, we were on Javier Becerra to join the investigation from before the campaign was very public. I mean, it's been going on for a while, and Becerra's statement has been continually that he doesn't comment on investigations. And I think, especially with Schneiderman being compromised, it would add a lot of gravitas to the investigation to have California join.
What I've been told in conversations, you know, again with a number of sitting attorneys general and former attorneys general, kind of two fronts. The first being, they have seen, Becerra has seen, and certainly AGs of the smaller states have seen just how ferociously Exxon fights. So it becomes a question of resources to some of these attorneys general. Do they have the resources? Are they willing to commit to a fight that could go on for years and years and years against a company that, you know, has probably a $1 billion legal budget? So I think is one of the factors in the calculation that Becerra maybe, as well as other state attorneys generals, may be on the sidelines watching the progress made by New York and Massachusetts before they jump into the fray, just simply because they want to see if it's going to be worth the fight in the end.
Well, just noting, California's Attorney General's office has more resources than any other Attorney General's office in the country. I mean, think about poor little Massachusetts out there. I hate to think that it's fear of Exxon.
Making excuses for Becerra. Believe me, we have been pressuring his office, and in fact, about 6 weeks ago, Becerra, Maura Healey, and Brian Frosch had occasion to have a roundtable with the media. We had a reporter there, and we confronted him with the very same issue. And of course, his position was, I don't talk about investigations. But we have tried to come at this question to get an answer from a number of different angles, and we're not getting that answer. You know, we're getting he's on the sidelines because he doesn't want to commit. If you look at Dave Jones is making the case that, well, Becerra may be beholden to the oil and gas industry, or that the oil and gas industry has a big presence in California, any number of reasons. Now, all of that being said, maybe Becerra is behind the scenes doing an investigation. But there is, at this point, no outward evidence that he's doing anything but watching.
He is taking some campaign contributions from the oil companies, I believe.
I believe so, yes.
Can we talk about how these oil companies are responding and what their arguments are? Jason Mark in the LA Times had an interesting piece last month about the landmark case in federal court. 8 California cities and counties are suing to make Chevron, Exxon, Shell, and other companies pay for some of the tens of millions of dollars that local governments must spend to prepare for rising sea levels. And here is a quote from Theodore Boutrous, an attorney for Chevron. And last month in court, he said, quote, "Chevron accepts the scientific consensus regarding climate change." And then he said, telling the court, it's not energy companies like Chevron driving global warming, but, quote, how people are leading their lives. What about that, Dave?
That is the fundamental argument that the industry is making. They're not arguing the climate science. They can't argue the climate science because the climate science is so clear. So they have to find a fallback defense. And that defense is, look, we just brought this stuff out of the ground and refined it. We didn't create the CO2. Now, you can argue that, you know, emissions from refining and the exploration, but they're simply saying, not our fault. You know, you have to take into account the consumers of our product. And so that's the bottom line defense that the industry is putting forward, as well as the larger issue of the industry saying, and the specific company saying, okay, how can you identify emissions specific to our product? So there are a number of technical arguments being made by the industry, and I think the way the cities and counties are going to try to get around the one argument of how can you pin it on us? How can you identify the CO2 emissions to our specific product? And I think the way that the cities and counties are going to try to get around that is that they are going to go through the public records of these oil and gas companies, and they are going to say, you know, for the last decade, you have produced X barrels of oil, X number of cubic yards of natural gas, and extrapolate from that the emissions that would have been created.
And I should say that LA Times piece that I mentioned was written by Jason Mark, editor of Sierra Magazine. And Dave, this month they've got a massive story on their front page called The Case for Climate Reparations, Who Should Pay the Costs for Climate Change-Related Disasters. And Jason writes that the urgency of this attempt cannot be overstated. This effort to apportion responsibility is in a race against time. The longer the carbon barons are able to delay justice, the sooner a worse judgment will come for all of us, the innocent as well as the guilty. So, Dave, you're saying that these lawsuits could be taking place for years?
Oh, absolutely. And again, if you want to use the big tobacco as an example, it took a decade to litigate. And what you're seeing in, for example, the hearing in San Francisco, it's a motion hearing brought by the 5 oil and gas companies to dismiss the lawsuit. No matter which way the judge rules, and that ruling in all likelihood won't occur until mid to late summer, the losing side will appeal it. That will take time. And once the appellate decision is rendered, that appellate decision will be appealed. It will go on for a long time. And this is just on the question of, can these lawsuits proceed? Once there's a definite answer, and assuming that the definite answer is yes, they can proceed, then comes the fight over discovery, the internal documents, who knew what when. The legal back and forth will go on for years. And you can see that in the way Exxon has started to fight. Exxon went to state court in Texas to convince a state court judge in Texas to allow the company essentially to go on the offensive and investigate the cities and counties that have brought suit against it. It has asked a Texas court to allow it to depose and seek discovery addressing the question of what's the motive behind these cities and counties bringing suit. So the litigation will take years.
Wow. We have about a minute left, Janet. Howard writes in, these companies are the true enemies of the people. We must stand up for ourselves and defend one another. However, the stated value of the companies depends on their share price. What role are activists going to play from here on out?
Well, I think we just need to keep talking about both the lawsuits and the if you look at the divestment movement, it's not focused on putting the companies out of business. It's focused on changing the public attitude about the companies and removing their moral license to continue to do what they're doing. And I think that, you know, while these lawsuits proceed, we all need to be talking about it and working on it and figuring out how we can move to an economy that doesn't depend on the oil companies. And we've got to do everything we can all the time, all of us. So if you haven't started already, start now.
Janet Cox is an activist with Fossil Free California, an organization that addresses the causes of climate change by focusing on the public and private financing of fossil fuel companies. Janet, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dave Hassmeyer is a reporter with Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit organization that provides reporting on climate and the environment. Dave co-authored the 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist series, Exxon, The Road Not Taken. Dave, as always, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. If you'd like to listen to past shows, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our podcast. Malihei Raz is on produced today's show. Josh Wilner is our social media producer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.